Welcome.
I've just been censored.
Yes.
Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. We are in Venice, and I've set up shop next to a canal. You might have just heard one of the canal boats. Anyway, I'm here with Jessica Kieng, who has been writing for Variety, Sight and Sound, and New York Times, or will have written for the New York
Times. I will have written.
She's the future perfect.
Future perfect. Yes. Love a bit of future perfect.
but I'm glad we could find some time here in, I don't know, like the middle of the final week, but this is also the time when people are already kind of departing a little.
Yeah, people are starting to go to Toronto and stuff. And actually, I think especially this year, the way it's the festival is set up, it really does seem to fall off the end of this week.
Yeah.
The last 3 or 4 days, they clearly have put a lot of their much lower profile competition titles and some of the very long ones. So,
I guess there was something interesting that happened, that there was an Ava DuVernay movie that's on the Wednesday, which suddenly got picked up by Toronto.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, interesting.
There's also like a...
There's a Michel Franco film.
Michel Franco film, and there is a movie about the Andes plane crash.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's a closing film.
That's a closing film.
Society of the Snow. That's Bayona. Yeah.
But we'll talk about what we've seen so far, which is plenty. You might have heard about a couple of films. Maybe we can talk about the first one of this week that was screened for the press. Priscilla, directed by Sofia Coppola. It's a rare case of a movie where the two main stars are also here. Jacob Elordi and...
Kaylee Spaney.
And what did you make of Priscilla?
So... I don't know, for whatever reason, going into Priscilla, I had heard some really negative advance word.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's one of the higher profile competition titles here. And, you know, with Sofia Coppola especially being a previous winner in Venice. And so there was a whole kind of like thing about how quite a few of the high profile American titles here have been slightly mid. I know we're not going to talk about them necessarily right now, but like I found Maestro a bit disappointing. I found The Killer a bit anonymous. I haven't seen Ferrari, but I also hear that from a few people that's kind of where it's landed for a lot of people. And so I went into Priscilla with my expectations very, very low, which I think is probably a good thing, because I actually came out of it then actually genuinely enjoying it. And I did like it for what it was. I don't think it's amazing, but I think that it, you know, plays to certain of her strengths really well. It also then, however, shows up a pretty glaring weakness, specifically in this story that she's telling, which is obviously the story of Priscilla Presley meeting Elvis, marrying him, and then just got up to the point of her sort of tentative liberation. There's a whole deal made about Elvis as a young man, played by Jacob Elordi. So when they first meet, it's when he's famously a US GI, and he is based in a US base in Germany somewhere.
West Germany at the time.
In West Germany at the time. I can't remember. Yeah. Anyway, they fly into Frankfurt at one point. So you're right, somewhere around there.
That's right.
And that's when he meets then 15-year-old Priscilla Beaulieu. And because a lot of the film, certainly the early going of it, is kind of, you know, it tackles quite head on the ickiness of the age gap. And, you know, it does a good job, I think, actually, of stressing that Elvis, you know, the legend that he is, and obviously we've just seen Elvis, but like Elvis, the legend that he is, obviously had some pretty major character flaws as well, but doesn't go all out making him some sort of like slavering evil symbol of the patriarchy or whatever. However, one of the things that it negotiates is about that it goes in quite clearly on is when exactly he has sex with Priscilla for the first time, which is kind of a big deal when if you consider he met her when she was 15 years old. So there's quite a big deal made about early on about, no, we're not going to, you know, calm yourself down, Priscilla. Not tonight, darling. that he's sort of, you know, restraining himself and holding back. And there is no sex scene. There's no That's point true. At which we are actually sure when that event goes down. And I think it's kind of interesting in the context of today's weirdly puritanical debate around right. whether or not sex scenes belong in the movies. This is a movie where a sex scene absolutely contingently belongs in a movie, and it's not there.
Right.
So there is this whole sort of, you know, thing made about when exactly he is going to have sex with Priscilla, and right. then we never actually know that it happens, and then boom, she's pregnant. So it's like, okay, at some point along there it happened. Maybe it happened during a montage, which we just see like lots of dinner plates being piled outside the door on the night of her graduation. You know, maybe it was then, but there's no actual flesh on display. There's no actual skin shown as to when that actually happens. And I think it's a strange misstep for a film like this. I think it's also quite characteristic of Sofia Coppola, who I think is sort of uncomfortable around the sort of the nitty gritty of that.
Yeah.
But in many other ways, I think it's really a fantastic Sofia Coppola film. There is like certain scenes and certain recreations, especially, that I think that, you know, she's probably the best person in the world to have told this particular story.
Yeah.
And if by any chance you were not aware that it was a Sofia Coppola movie, I think the very first shot will kind of disavow you of that, which is of pink toenails, coral colored right. toenails, walking across very plush carpet, like sinking into a plush pink carpet.
Yeah.
And it's just the most Sofia Coppola opening shot I think I could ever possibly imagine. And I mean, I think both the actors are really good. I think Kaylee Spaney is kind of like, considering that's, I don't know how you felt, but it felt to me like a pretty thankless role as written. I think it might have been like on the page a little bit underwritten, actually, because you are slightly frustrated for a lot of it, of just being like, you know, you're too young. And and the excuses that you hear Priscilla within the film making for why she is in this clearly very unbalanced relationship,
right,
you know, are so torturously obvious from the outside.
Yeah, her mother doesn't buy a word of it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's all of those elements that are, you know, it's so much stuff that we've all discussed ad nauseam as part of the discourse, and so to see it sort of retread there can be quite painful.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, Kaylee Spaney somehow manages to give a little bit of, I don't know, a little bit of interiority to this character who could be defined entirely in terms of her youth and her sort of relative victimhood, I suppose.
Right.
And it does make the second half of the film and the like the end of the film, where she's moving towards some sort of tentative steps towards sort of self-actualization, and it makes that quite satisfying, that arc, I think.
Yeah. I mean, she gives her a real kind of thoughtfulness, and you actually feel like you're seeing her come into her own and get more self-possession.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's the thing. Like, early on, it is frustrating to watch, because you are just, I mean, I remember what I was like at 15. And, you know, while I was very different from Priscilla Beaulieu at 15, still there's a kind of it's almost a discomfort of recognizing in myself, even at that age, how ill-equipped I would have been to have made huge life decisions like I'm moving to Graceland to be Elvis's girlfriend. It takes quite some skill, I think, and I all props to Kaylee Spaney for actually being able to sort of make that, you know, sympathetic, I guess, you know, if still playing to the fact that, you know, she's a very young, very callow and very naive girl.
And I think also Jacob Elordi kind of underplays the Elvis charisma. It's kind of, Elvis in movies has been a kind of byword for people giving these really out there performances, you know. I don't know, I guess maybe it's Nicolas Cage that kind of sits, just the whole, every other performance of his is somehow shadowed by Elvis, I think. But in this case, he's kind of more underplays it, which it ends up being really effective, because one thing that I thought was really strong was showing some of the violence, really,
yeah,
which is genuinely surprising, because so much of the movie has this placid, you know, Coppola sort of surface that it usually does. You know, she almost gives more attention, or she does give more attention to all the pill popping.
Yes.
Which is also very present. I mean, it is a movie that makes sense for her to take on, but also something about the violence felt a little new. Like, there's recurring thing in her movies is living around, being in the shadow of, also enjoying the charisma, the presence, everything about a big personality, a big artistic personality very often.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is neglect a little bit, or indifference, or just kind of this spaced outedness. I mean, I love Somewhere. You know, I think that father-daughter story is so interesting. I mean, I might be wrong, but this is one where I don't really remember there being this kind of violence. I don't want to overplay the violence, but I don't remember there being something that felt kind of shocking like it does in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, well, and also the other side of it is that this is the third, at least, very high-profile Venice competition movie to deal with the desire on the part of men to control the women that they are married to. So, well, Poor Things, it's not a marriage story, but certainly it's like 100% about that. Mm-hmm. And then Maestro, the Carrie Mulligan character in Maestro, who is Leonard Bernstein's wife, there seems to be a recurring theme going on here. And obviously that's very much part of Priscilla. I think you can also tell from Priscilla that it's based on Priscilla Presley's own autobiography, Elvis and Me, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there is a certain degree to which it feels a little bit self-exculpatory or something, or just, but again, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, especially in the context of dealing with somebody who was in a relationship that was so power imbalanced.
Yeah.
And there is something kind of interesting, again, harking back to Maestro as well, of like, you know, putting the emphasis on the woman who is in the shadow of an incredibly more famous and very much controlling husband. I mean, there's a moment in Elvis where he makes her change her hair color, and it's so creepy. It's such a creepy fucking thing to do to a 15-year-old, to make her look older and to make her look more like him and like more like she sort of fits his ideas or whatever.
Yeah.
So. There's just, it seems to me, to be this sort of interesting recurring theme that's happening across the Venice election. But I think that Priscilla does it in a very kind of standard biopic-y way. And there are other like nitpicks I could make about the way the movie is put together. It's a little bit montage-y for my liking. It's a little bit sort of stop-start. And there are some time transitions, which I was not sure about. But overall, I genuinely pleasantly surprised. And I really enjoyed the process of watching it. Like it was not a hard watch. It wasn't it wasn't particularly challenging, but it was so much more enjoyable, like even visually pleasurable.
Yeah.
And that a lot of that is down to things like costumes, things like surfaces, the decor, and the really immaculate recreation of some of those, of some of the hairstyles. Some of them even like wildly exaggerated, because I went back and looked at, there's one particular one where she's just given birth and she leaves the hospital and she has this beehive, which is just so enormous. I was like, it can't have been that enormous. And I looked up the actual pictures from that occasion and it was pretty enormous, but it was not as enormous as it is in the film. So there is some exaggeration going on there.
Poetic license.
And I also wonder if it was partially there to somewhat mitigate the height differential between Kayleigh Spaney and Jacob Elordi, because Jacob Elordi is enormously tall.
He does
kind of tower over him. I mean, Elvis was significantly taller than Priscilla, but not to the degree that that those two are, you know, are different in height. So.
Yeah, it almost underlined just like her girlness,
yes.
You know, and so it seemed to work for that. Because, yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it's sort of uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because she's so much a girl, and even later on at one point, because there is they are in the bedroom a lot.
Yeah,
not much happens there, and in fact, like the most, I would say, like, sexual encounter they have there is when they're taking pictures of each other.
That's right. Yes.
That's probably like the hottest scene.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
It kind of all gets displaced to that, and they really enjoy that. They're taking all these Polaroids and doing poses and everything.
Yes, exactly. Sexy poses. Yeah. But even then, that was one of the things where I was like, so does this mean that they've had sex? Because you would imagine if you're taking sexy Polaroids of somebody, you've had sex with them. But like, again, it was just not clear when that had gone down.
Yeah. But yeah, and one of those points, couple is so careful with costumes, all the production details. And she's also not like turning it up to 11, which is, I guess, the temptation. I mean, that again, Graceland, it's just a byword for like
excess.
Glitzy excess. Yeah. Quick word about the music, because I think people may also wonder about how the music is used. And there's, I think, very little
Elvis
singing. I mean, it's a lot of covers that he's doing other songs. The soundtrack itself is like Phoenix, right? Which is her husband, right?
That's right, I think.
Which is funny because you have songs from the period, but then you also have songs that are sort of foreground in their like buzzy electronicness.
Right. But I mean, I did think that the songs of the period that are not Elvis songs were really kind of brilliantly deployed.
Yeah, I agree.
In many cases. Crimson and Clover, that plays out at one point and it's just a really beautiful moment. And I did think it was almost like a joke, the very end. I mean, a good joke, a funny joke, where she drives out to to the strains of Dolly Parton's yes. I Will Always Love You. And it was kind of like she's leaving the great icon of 20th century music for another great icon of 20th century music. So, yeah, leaving Graceland for Dollywood.
Yeah, Dolly and Paragon.
Yes.
However. Because I actually came out of it and I felt like the response was pretty muted within in the room. Mm. Definitely the rhythm of the movie is pretty concertedly like one thing after another, kind of like this. The editing yes. of it is kind of a block, block, block. And that kind of put me off in a while. But then it kind of had an interesting kind of flattening effect that I felt was interesting given the subject again. You know, it's like she's not going to, the, you know, rocket of Elvis's career or charisma was not, she was not going to let that take over the movie.
Yes, exactly. And like, and even, I mean, even Elvis himself, his problems, even though he was this incredible dominating, domineering influence. Like, I mean, there's even like, there's only one conversation, phone conversation that he has with Colonel Tom Parker.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I mean, in refocusing our attention onto the person in, you know, who is in the shadows.
Yeah.
It does that really well and really nicely. It does do it in a very Sofia Coppola way, mm-hmm. though, as well. I don't think we get, she's not a great director of depth or subversion, I don't think. She's a great director of surfaces. And so she tells the story in terms of surface after surface, like costume after costume. And if you can get onto that wavelength, and if you are enjoying it, the sheer visual pleasures that it can offer, those surface pleasures, then I think it's available to you to read a lot more depth into it. But I'm not sure that it's actually there. I mean, I was very pleasantly surprised by it because yeah. I'd heard such bad things in advance. But I can't say I adore it or like 100% right. endorse it or really think that there's a huge amount there.
Right. What did you think of Elvis from last year's camp?
I hated Elvis.
So you just hate Elvis.
I do. I just hate Elvis. Yeah. Yeah. Cancel me immediately. I hate Elvis.
Glad I got that out there. Well, I can't wait also just to hear what people who know much more about Elvis than I do will have to say about the movie and how it feels. Shout out to Sheila O'Malley, who's
a huge Elvis fan. Yes,
Elvis fan extraordinaire, Elvis scholar, I would say.
All right.
Let's talk about another movie. Maybe we can sort of go in an entirely different direction. Hitman. Is it just Hitman or is it The Hitman?
It's Hitman.
Hitman. It's just Hitman, which is, I think, the 17th movie with a hitman.
In Venice this year.
I might be counting wrong, but it's definitely up there. There's also like a Liam Neeson movie where that has a hitman. That
In the Land of Saints and Sinners, it plays tomorrow.
Okay, there you go.
So I don't know if I'll say this is the best hitman, but it's a very, very good hitman.
Hitman because he's not really a hitman.
That's right. That's not giving anything away. That's kind of the premise.
Premise of the whole thing. And in fact, it's like the first thing he says.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting when you're saying like there's too many hitman movies here in Venice, because premise of this one is that there is no such thing as a hitman.
That's
and
right.
that we've all been basically duped into believing that there are hitmen because of the movies.
That's true.
Because of all these fucking movies, such as Killer, The Killer or whatever, which tell us that such people exist.
Yeah.
And the very funny, ironic voiceover that Glenn Powell delivers in Hitman, one of the first things he says in that voiceover is that he pretends, so the premise is him pretending to be a hitman in order to entrap, essentially, people who are seeking to, you know, hire a contract killer. But his initial thing is just how ridiculous that is, because there's no such thing as a contract killer. And so he can quite happily play this role because it isn't actually attached to anything in the real right. world, which is also, I mean, it's a really interesting idea, I think, even just that by itself, because I did suddenly start wondering, like, hang on, like, are there contract, I mean, if there aren't contract killers, we have really been sold a pup by just almost every movie.
Not speaking from experience, but I think there are.
Okay, all right. Yes. Nicholas Rapolt has clearly had a few people offed.
Never used their services, but I've seen a lot of true crime.
Yes.
Like, it must exist.
Exactly.
They definitely exist within, like, mob sort of circles. Like,
yes.
There are people who specialize
yes.
in it.
There are people who specialize in it. So, I mean, it's almost, when the voiceover says that, it almost kind of introduces, like, this is a slightly alternate reality or something. And it does really set up the jokey tone of this film, which is a very funny comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, the main character is, what he actually is, is a university teacher.
Yeah, university civics teacher civics or something. Teacher. Yeah, he seems to be because he's always talking about ethics and nature and whatever.
Yeah. And so there's a fair amount of philosophy in the movie.
Yeah.
Right? And throughout the movie, they're cutting to some, you know, climactic point in some lecture about Nietzsche or whoever else. And I think in some ways they really fit really nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not done so plunkily as that often is done, where, you know, in the classroom they are saying the exact germane thing that will then explain or unlock all of the behaviors in the rest of the film.
Yeah.
So it's not that obvious. But like, honestly, the main thing for me, the main surprise of this, I really went in, and yet another film I went in with like sub-zero expectations for this. Also playing out of competition in sort of like, you know, in the middle of the festival. The omens weren't particularly auspicious,
it's
I suppose.
Out of competition. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's out of competition. And then you consider something like fucking Dog Man is in competition. I mean, whatever. Clearly I think out of competition mainly because of the general prejudice against comedies. And this is like absolutely a comedy. It doesn't make any bones. And it's a very silly comedy actually when it comes down to it, but really enjoyable and really completely announcing the arrival of Glenn Powell as well as a force to be reckoned with. He's just so charismatic and so versatile within the role. He also co-wrote the script. And I think that you can really, he's just having an amazing time, but it really feels like somebody's stepping into the position of just being a star.
Yeah.
Like he's going to be a star after this. I mean, certainly in my mind he is. And there's a funny thing that happens in it where, I mean, the fundamental premise aside from him, he's a university lecturer and he is sort of on a very casual basis attached to the New Orleans Police Department, mainly as a sort of a tech backup guy for this other horrendous character called Jasper, who is the one who is the guy who basically, it's his job as a police officer to pretend to be the contract killer, to go and lure these people into handing over money, at which point they can be arrested for soliciting a murder. And Jasper can't do the job anymore, so suddenly at the very last minute, Gary, who is the character played by Glenn Powell, is this very you know, unassuming, very like dorky university professor.
Got the perfect detail. I just said is that when he eats his dinner, it's on a table for one person.
A table for
kitchen.
One. Yes, exactly. Even though his two cats, Ego and Id,
one of which has a cast.
One of which has a cast. Even the cats get to eat together, but he has this little like one lonely table. And he's also at the very beginning when he's giving his lectures, he is this very dorky thing, and you can even see the kids in his class kind of like shifting and like talking over him, and you know he has no mojo in the classroom.
Zero cred.
But in the course of doing this hitman job, when he's starting to impersonate the hitman, he goes and there's a whole variety of people. It's done in quite a quick montage of all the various people that he successfully gets to incriminate themselves in this way. And he starts to become this sort of master of disguise as well, which leads to some very funny bits where he's doing accents and, you know, changing his hairstyle and everything. And then it's when he hits on the character of Rom, which is his alter ego, becomes his alter ego. And he becomes hot. Like, he literally becomes hot, like, almost before your eyes. And there is a lovely moment then when he's back, actually as Gary again, but he's got a little bit of Ron rubbing off on him. And he's in the classroom, and one of the students actually turns to the other and, like, asks her friend, like, Jesus, when did our teacher become hot?
Right.
And there's something always very satisfying about that. It's almost like a makeover movie, where you can just, like, oh, my God, this is clearly the same guy. And he obviously is Glenn Powell, who is inherently a very handsome man, but there is something very like satisfying and funny about the way it plays out here. It's just a guy accruing coolness and accruing sexual attractiveness as he goes, and that ultimately then becomes the moral of the whole film. If this like markedly amoral film can really have a moral, it is about deciding who it is that you want to be and then just being that, like faking it until you make it kind of thing, faking it until that becomes part of your personality. And I think like it's very funny and actually quite sexy and sort of romantic as well. I really liked the sort of the central love affair that he has
with this actress Adria Arjona.
Yes. And they're both really good, and there's and you know, even when it gets goes very ridiculous at the end. And we should say this is actually based on a real guy, but he did not actually commit any murders, which end up happening in the film. So even when it goes to there, you're still sort of rooting for this couple to make it all the way through. But yeah, so this idea that you can choose your identity to a certain degree and change yourself to become it is actually really interesting if you consider it in the context of Richard Linklater's career, I think, as well. I mean, especially considering, aside from the before movies, the before trilogy, Boyhood is probably his biggest, best-known film and best-loved film. And Boyhood is so much about like the opposite of that. Boyhood is so much about the sort of almost forensic, you know, detail of watching somebody grow into who they are, but like, you know, tracing the sort of the evolution of a personality that you feel is going to be set forever. You know, it's like through those childhood and teenage years, that's when we're sort of unformed, and then we become the people that we're always going to be. Yeah. So just the fundamental premise of this, which is just feels very hopeful and very kind of change is still possible no matter how entrenched in your adult personality you feel like you are.
Yeah, and along the way, I think he makes a good decision of not making it sort of about the suspense per se, or about like the, because it overlaps in many ways. When she said, yeah, it's more like character about character than it is about, you know, any umpteenth number of movies that are about like double identities or being going undercover. He knows he's not going to try to make like, I don't know, like Training Day or something, you know, where you're being sucked in.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe it's a spoiler, but like, he doesn't like, and maybe it's amoral as well. Like, it's not like about good and evil per se.
Yeah.
Which I guess some people have said is kind of an ethically challenged aspect of it. I mean, he has more fun with just the rhythms and often the screwball rhythms of scenes, of the secrets he's keeping. And there's just one scene that at the press screening I was at that I live for these moments where the whole room just erupted in applause at the kind of byplay.
It's a brilliant scene. I know exactly the scene that you're talking about, and it's just so good. It's okay. Okay, I won't give anything about it. Anyway, it was really good.
Good.
And it involves phones.
Yeah, it involves a couple. It involves phones.
There's about like six different things going on at the same time. And they play them. So like the two actors play that so well.
Yeah.
And the communicating stuff that they can't say out loud because people are listening in. It's just, it's really, really well done and really inventively staged. I think that's it's a really great scene. It's a showstopper.
Yeah, it's great. So yeah, this was, you know, also a nice movie. Not that people really care about me, but it was a good movie for me to see at that point in the festival. You know, I'd seen like the Beast, Aggro Drift, and like The Killer. And so to see this movie, you know, a comedy, which, yeah, comedies need to get more respect.
Yes, they really do, especially when they're just as well made and as you know, it's a comedy, but it does have something going on under the hood as well. It does have some ideas there, and it has a sort of a bounce and a vitality to it that a lot of the more serious dramas that we have been seeing do not have.
It's true. Yeah.
I really hope people check this one out. I think it deserves to be a hit, and Glenn Powell deserves to be a big star off the back of it.
Yeah, definitely. What should we talk about? Like, immigration crisis, I guess. Green Border, newest film by Agnieszka Holland.
She's 74, and
been directed and writing, so just...
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I think, like, you have these, like, great directors, and people just kind of, they fall off people's radars.
I think in her case as well, I mean, she is a really solid, like, consistent director, but I think that, like, solidity and consistency aren't necessarily the sexiest of attributes. And especially now that she's getting on a bit, and, like, a few of her movies do tend to play in competition in Berlin, or they play in competition here in Venice, or whatever it is. And I think that there's a slight sense of kind of worthiness or something around her, which is unfair. When it comes to this film, I think also just entirely unjustified. This is like definitely, I mean, I think this has to be a front runner for some prize here. And I think it's a really remarkably well achieved film. And really quite harrowing, quite devastating in how it's put together, but cleverly put together as well. Like, not it's not misery porn, and it's not some kind of, it doesn't sort of bludgeon you with its message. And in fact, I think what I felt, and I've just written the review of this, so these are all sort of top of my mind, but what I felt strangely about it, even though there are some absolutely, like, really devastating scenes and some really, really moving and really traumatic scenes within it,
yeah.
The overriding feeling I got from it, and it's not glib at all, is this sort of sense of activism and of optimism. Mm-hmm. The optimism, yeah, that if people know, if people just know, and if people just see this crisis dramatized in the right way, like not in an overtly sentimentalized way and not in a way that's really trying to push your buttons, yeah, but if people just see things well done, like thoughtfully dramatized, that there is a it is more fundamental for us to want to help each other than it is for us to want these kind of things to happen.
Yeah.
So there's something kind of just appealing to a more basic sense of human decency, and that's it's so important to me. I don't know, I don't want to sound too like Pollyanna-ish here. This is a really harsh movie, and it's, mm-hmm, there are times when it's hard to watch, and it doesn't undersell any of the many utter tragedies and the instances of torture, essentially,
right,
that it shows. But just this notion that isn't the way things are supposed to be, that this isn't the way things have to be,
right,
that systemic, even as systemic and horrible and like pervasive as those basically abrogations of human rights that occur on borders all over the world,
yeah,
this is a very specific border, but this happens all over the world, wherever there's an immigration crisis, which is basically everywhere,
yeah,
that is not inevitable, that it is not, that's not baked into who we are as people, and in,
right,
fact, it's a perversion of a much more fundamental instinct towards human compassion and decency. Yeah, I found this really powerful and was really impressed. I think it deserves to get as wide an audience as possible.
Yeah.
And yeah, really just brilliantly mounted, really absorbing, very characterful drama.
Yeah, I don't know if we gave like a recap a bit of just like, I mean, it starts off, you're mostly following a Syrian family.
And this is specifically during the 2021 Belarusian-Polish,
yes,
border crisis.
Right.
So where Alexander Lukashenko, who is the Belarusian dictator, had broadcast basically this notion that his country, that Belarus, was going to be a haven of safe passage for refugees fleeing whatever war-torn or persecutory country that they were coming from, to be able to get into the EU. He was sort of guaranteed them safe passage through to the border. But that whole announcement and everything was basically a part of a sort of a ruse on his part, because he was rattling his saber with regards to the EU. He had the EU-Belarus relations had already deteriorated to such a position that he had threatened to quote-unquote flood the EU with immigrants and drugs and whatever he could like push,
right,
over that border. So the film Green Border actually like deals with one of the people, with one of the families. Well, it starts with one of the families who are really caught up in that, who believe the promise of this safe passage.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like, heartrendingly early on, the mother of the family, Amina, she says to her new acquaintance, Leila, who's an Afghan refugee on the same flight into Belarus, she says how, yes, this land crossing into the EU is, you know, is a godsend compared to the horrible stories she's heard about immigrants trying to get into the EU over,
right,
By sea. And of course, that in itself is, you know, a horrendous thing. But like then to hear that and to know the hope that these refugees had in their hearts with,
yeah,
this. So they land in Belarus. They are brought to the Belarusian Polish border, and immediately the entire tenor of everything changes. They are pushed across, like under the razor wire, which separates the two countries, basically beaten over by rifle butts and at the threat of at gunpoint. And they have to run through this no man's land. They basically, you know, barely make it through the night. There's families, there's nursing mothers, there's pregnant women, and they barely make it over the night. But they're at least happy that they're in Poland. They have eternally draining batteries on their cell phones, which is part of the like tension of the whole thing. But does one of the phones does actually indicate that they're in Poland, and there's this moment of relief,
yeah,
and it's a very very brief moment of relief because then the Polish border guards come and round them up, and in one of these migrant pushbacks, which is the delightful euphemism for this, they literally round them up and drive them back to the border and push them back back through that razor wire so that they're again on the Belarusian side. The Belarusian border guards are incredibly brutal, incredibly, just absolutely violent and brutal. They start to realize that this is going to continue to happen. And in fact, they meet one, a fellow migrant who has been pushed back and forth across that border 5 or 6 times, he says, already. Yeah. They're not given food, and oftentimes they are beaten for the minorest of infractions. So that part of it is so powerful, and you love this family so much that it becomes this really, it becomes really immediate and it becomes really close to you. And then in what I think is a really daring choice, actually, we realize that actually Holland's screenplay, which was co-written with 2 other writers as well, I should say, it actually encompasses far more than just this family story. Yeah. So she actually starts to go into the stories of various other people involved in that border crisis, and people who we will see in different contexts. And so she deals with, there's a whole chapter about the activists who are on the Polish side who are trying to help the migrants. And then there's a particular woman who is a local who lives nearby, who gets embroiled in the whole activism thing because she is basically politicized or radicalized by this incredibly traumatic thing that happens to her when she hears somebody crying for help in the forest near her home. But I think probably most controversially and most provocatively is the section that deals with Jan, the border guard. Right. So one of these chapters is entirely about Jan, the Polish border guard, who actively participates in some of the worst of the atrocities that we see. And yes, he is a human being, but it is this, the film in no way sort of resorts to some sort of both sidesism or, you know, like does this whole thing of like, well, actually, there are good people on all, you know, it is more to me again about what I was saying about that sort of fundamental compassion, because even though Jan he's a bad guy, he's doing these absolutely terrible things, and then going back to his pregnant wife and kind of pretending that he's not participating in those, it is actually almost taking such a toll on his spirit that he, you know, he starts to drink, he starts to behave in ways that are, we are given to understand, are not part of his nature ordinarily. So to me, again, even with that section, it is just showing again how this kind of behavior, where it can be carried out by people who are doing the just following orders thing or it's my duty, and can be very blinded and very brainwashed in that way, it is the aberration. It is not the way people are built. You know, people are not built to behave in this way towards each other. I think it's that section was in its way incredibly moving as well.
Yeah. And the way she kind of moves from one section to the next and shifts her emphasis among them and finds ways of keeping you in the story at different points. I mean, for example, a person who's traveling with a Syrian family, you don't know exactly what her origin is. She seems to have maybe a different background, and the way she quietly but slowly gradually brings out that character.
Yes, she's Afghanistan. She's from Afghanistan.
It comes to a point where she's Agnieszka Holland is developing the idea of like acts of conscience, you know, that this exists, you know, that this is a strain of our identities. It's one of those movies that's like both an effective drama and
not just a drama, it feels like a thriller at times. It's really tense.
Yeah.
And really gripping, and you know, even those moments which are quieter, there's a sort of underlying zinging unease throughout the whole thing, which really keeps you gripped. And then I think one of the other really clever things is, obviously this is set in 2021, most of it, and then there's an epilogue, which actually encompasses then, the epilogue is set in February 2022, and it moves to the Polish-Ukrainian border instead. And there's scenes of the Ukrainian refugees coming in and the way that the border guards treat them. Mm-hmm. And the border guards treat them differently, obviously, than they treat the Syrian and Afghan and Moroccan refugees that they are treated on the Belarusian border. But it's also, and obviously there are racism reasons for that, aside from anything else, but mostly, without in any way detracting from the plight of the Ukrainians at the border, it's really, to me, again, just emphasized how we can treat people so differently, like to the point of like beating and murdering them, merely because they fall on the wrong side of some political fucking game that is nothing to do with their plights. It's nothing to do with the horrors that they are fleeing in their home countries. It has nothing to do with how much they deserve to be in whatever place that they were just to have a safe home. It is all to do with the decision of some fucking strongman dictator somewhere, and how much that like that can trickle down to the individual level, where like an individual border guard will feel fully justified and will beat somebody with impunity simply because of a decision that has been made miles away that has nothing to do with him, and it is not connected in any way to actual reality. Yeah. I even thought the way that the Ukrainian crisis was just you know, put in there at the end to recontextualize mm-hmm. a little bit was really, really clever and really well done.
Yeah, it was an ambition that succeeds, really. Like, I mean, that's like a big swing at the end, and it's great.
Yeah, and it's also, and it shows in some of the faces of the Ukrainian refugees and them getting onto their buses, you know, it shows the basic level of misery that these people are going through without having to, you know, face torture at the borders.
Right.
They are immiserated by the loss of their homes, by not having any of their possessions with them, by not knowing where each other is, you know, all of that displacement and dislocation. And to think that those sensations are exactly the same for the Syrian borders coming across the Belarusian border, and then yet they are also the ones who are starved and beaten and drowned and God knows what.
Yeah, the refugees themselves become weaponized. They're, at one point, there's like they're Lukashenko's weapons, is there something?
Yes, the one of Yan's captains,
propaganda.
I guess, he is brainwashing his troop, he repeatedly refers to them as these are not people. You have to remember that these people coming across, they're not people, and then he calls them, they are bullets, they are live bullets that have been fired into your country, because he basically does regard them as, you know, non-human, non-sentient things that are, you know, missiles or whatever that have been sent in by Lukashenko, and so therefore, you know, therefore you're justified,
anything goes,
obviously, anything goes, you're justified in doing anything to repel these bullets, this weaponry.
And I'm sure this happens everywhere, but, you know, for like an American viewer, it also has the resonance with the way immigrants are, you know, shipping, you know, Republican political figures who ship refugees and drop them in, like, you know, democratic strongholds to like throw it in their face, like, you know, meanwhile just using these people that's causing them more suffering by just using them as, which is absolutely just disgusting, and it doesn't even get talked about in the right way in the US. It gets talked about like it's some political, what's the word they use, like stunt, and that just makes invisible the whole thing that this whole movie is playing. Yeah.
I also, I mean, and even just so like aesthetically, formally, so the movie is in black and white, which I think is really interesting, an interesting choice. And it's also the way that it's in black and white is clever, because it's not doing a sort of a stylization Schindler's List thing.
Right.
It's not going that far in its sort of like the beauty and the squalor, but it's also not going to the other extreme of being very handheld, very like this is docu-realist, you know, gritty stuff either. So it walks that line really well, where you are, there are occasions of like just sort of happenstance kind of weird beauty that happens like within the compositions, but also there are other times when I was just genuinely grateful for the slight aesthetic distance that black and white creates. There is a particular scene which I recoiled in my seat, during which a pregnant woman is literally flung over that fence. And I mean, I don't know if I'd been able to handle that if it was shot in a more realist way. So yeah, I mean, I think it was, it's just really cleverly done as well.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there is something to the, it's not quite handheld. It's a very mobile camera.
It's very mobile, but it's not jerky, and it's not, doesn't try to sort of artificially create a sense of urgency through that sort of shaky cam thing, or even like artificially create like authenticity or anything. This is also, I think there's something really interesting as well about this idea that this is the kind of story that we're most used to seeing in a kind of a docudrama way, right? So we're most used to this kind of story tends to derive its, I don't know, its integrity or its impact from how close it can actually actively resemble a documentary about this kind of thing. And this does not do this. This is very clearly a drama. It's a scripted drama. Yeah. The actors, who are amazing and amazingly naturalistic in it, are, however, they are acting. You know, this is a drama that to a certain degree is quite a classical drama and quite classically mounted. And I think that that in itself is an interesting choice, because it's a way of telling stories that has proven impact, but that, you know, that doesn't in any way, I don't know, that doesn't exaggerate or detract from the reality of these situations, while also making them, drawing together a point in a really clever and often quite subtle way that I don't think that you would be able to get with the even within a documentary. It's
No, it kind of reminds you how like that whole shaky aesthetic is like a weak polemic, you know?
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
And this movie doesn't need it, doesn't use it.
Yeah.
It has other ways of getting through to you.
Yes. Of being very visceral and very, very moving.
Yeah. Green Border. Hopefully a movie people can see sooner than later.
Mm. I think it will. I don't think there's any doubt that this will be picked up as a matter of urgency, and I think it will win something here.
So we could end there, but maybe you kind of, but you did kind of blow my mind. This one other movie, which I wasn't even planning to talk much about, but yeah, the world needs to know.
Okay.
But yeah, this is the Woody Allen movie. It's called Coup de Chance. He shot it in French for, I guess, the first time. Married couple, the woman is having an affair. The husband finds out. Kind of fill in the blanks the rest of it. But there is a particular character detail about the husband, who again is the one who finds out, and another hitman.
It's another hitman.
Another hitman gets involved. I don't know. Yeah, take it away.
Okay, well, so the interesting, interestingly, I suppose, up until the point where I made this connection, I was like on very limp, pallid terms, I guess, enjoying this movie. I mean, certainly a lot more than anything that Woody Allen has done in a long time. And I think there were several reasons for that. I think like this, just the idea of him, it almost felt like a relief to me that he wasn't writing in English. He wasn't trying to be funny in English.
Yeah.
And I do know from some French acquaintances that apparently the French is very stilted and doesn't work at all. But me with my like comprehension of French, but not a fluent person's understanding of it, it sounded fine to me. And it sounded a lot more less tortured than his English language comedies have been recently.
I didn't hear any jokes about Brooklyn.
Exactly. And but also there was just like, because of that remove, I didn't hear the ways that his English can be so stilted now and sound so strange. I'm thinking especially of Rainy Day in New York, which, oh my God. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, on that level, and then I did think that the French actors, for whatever reason, brought a sort of breeziness to it, which I haven't seen in his films recently as well. I even thought that the photography, Vittorio Storaro's photography, was much better than it has been in the last couple of his, in Rifkin's Festival and Rainy Day in New York. So, you know, there were levels on which I was like, oh, this is fine. And then this thing occurred to me. So the husband, who is the, you know, he's ultimately the villain in the piece, has a hobby, and the hobby is referred to several times and shown several times. He has a huge room in his very well maintained, fantastically kitted out Paris apartment that he shares with his wife, and it has a train set in it. And it's a lot about him going in and showing off his train set to his guests, and it becomes a punchline, and him buying like extra accessories for the train set. And this would be sort of, you know, it's there partly, I think, to show the kind of controlling aspect of his personality that we may not necessarily suspect he has in the beginning. He seems like a fairly decent guy, if a wealth management guy and with a bit like with a dodgy background. But he seems like decent, and he's decent to his wife, and so it's used in that context. But then I was looking at it at one point, and I was suddenly like, oh my God, hang on, train set, and this is a Woody Allen film, and I don't know how well people are acquainted with the ins and outs of Dylan Farrow's accusations against Woody Allen, but a train set played a fairly big role in it. And as soon as that connection was made in my mind, it really did cast a whole weird light on the entire rest of the film. So I'm not really best placed, thankfully I'm not reviewing it, but I'm not really best placed to judge the film by the end of it, because I got so confused actually in my mind, wondering if this was deliberately placed, if the train set was deliberately placed there as a reference to the scandal or if it's like an unconscious thing. Because, I mean, there's a lot of other things he could have done rather right. than a train set. He could have been collecting stamps. He could have been, collecting butterflies or something. He could, he could have had something else to show that side of his personality. Yeah. But a train set just feels so peculiarly pointed. So yes, that's my take on the Woody Allen.
Yeah, I was kind of stunned to hear that because it does play a pretty pivotal role in the accounts. And yeah, I mean, this is something I think has happened in previous films of his. I mean, different people analyze, just read things into his films. I mean, I confess, I have read things into his couple of his movies. I think I don't even remember which one it was, but there's some movie where I realized, oh, this plot basically turns on like an older character trying to convince the world that this younger person is not telling the truth. I forget which one it was. I know that's
Irrational Man.
Maybe, yeah. Anyway, so these things can kind of creep in, and you can read them anyway. Well, this one really struck me because so like a train set and a parasite, like what apartment? It didn't even like. It already looks kind of weird, like
it does. It feels bolted on for a particular purpose. And if you're gonna bolt something on, does it? Why a train set of all things?
Yeah,
it was really So it really did throw me. I mean, and aside from that, there are certain pleasures in the film. I liked Valerie Le Mercier, the mother character. She's very clearly the sort of the Diane Keaton of this particular movie. And the other thing, I think the reason that I was enjoying it up to the point where I got completely derailed, no pun intended, was just that there isn't necessarily a Woody surrogate in this one.
Right.
And so, even in Rainy Day in New York, where I think the Woody surrogate is basically Timothy Chalamet, which is, wrap your brain around that one. And then obviously in Rifkin's Festival, where it's Wallace Shawn. And so here, there really isn't one. There is, I think, because it's in French, so he doesn't find an easy sort of avatar to put his own neuroses onto. So at least even the way the plot works, which is kind of silly, to be honest, and the very ending got a huge laugh in the screening, but I thought the ending was dumb.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's because it is also mostly about chance and happenstance and how which is a pretty limp thesis to hang your movie on. But anyway, just like not having that Woody Allen character there kind of was a bit refreshing to me.
Yeah.
It did make it feel a little bit like somebody doing a knockoff Woody Allen, but fine.
Yeah. Anyway, that's Coup de Chance. Look for it on, Amazon. So yeah, we can finish up there. Is there any one movie you're looking forward to that's still coming up? Or we could skip that.
Actually, I'm looking forward to the movie I'm going to see this evening,
okay.
Which is Snow Leopard by Pema Tseden,
yeah.
The Tibetan director who died, unfortunately, recently, but whose last few films, I think, have really been amazing. He did a film called Balloon, which is one of my favorites, and if anybody gets the chance to check out Pema Tseden's Balloon, I would really, really recommend it. So he has a new film, his last film, obviously, and posthumous film, Snow Leopard.
Yes.
Which is playing tonight, and I'm looking forward to.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we'll end it there. Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of the festival. I know you're here to the bitter end.
I am. Bitter ending.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.